Welcome, everyone. I'm so glad you're all here. While you just finished getting your drinks and sitting down, I'll just start. I just want everyone to meet everybody else. I assume most of you know most of everybody else, but just for those of you who actually don't, why don't you just go around and introduce yourselves? Starting with you.
I'm Mindy Tannenbaum.
Michael Tannenbaum.
Iris F.
Angela.
Jana Lynn. Jacqueline.
Steve Buckley.
Lawrence
Grove. Our
host.
Mark
Gableman.
Eric Gable.
I.D. Westmark.
Eleanor
Westmark.
Hannah
Grove.
Dan
Grove. Hey, Dan. Okay, so just a few words of introduction before we actually get started. This is actually when the program is arranged, it's arranged for parents who are either expecting or are within their first year of having a child. And they encourage the creators of the program that there should be lots of babies around. They expect there to be lots of babies. So we have fulfilled that at least. We have two here, Baruch Hashem. So I'm upstairs making some noise. I'm sure we can come up with some others. It's totally fine and we'll be all right. My main word of introduction, two of them actually, number one. First of all, it's awesome that you're all here. Shirkayach, you should feel fantastic about that because, as we all know, marriage is hard, raising children is hard, it's just all hard. It's very rewarding, but it's difficult, and so to take out time to be able to work on it is fantastic, and I'm sure that you will all find this enjoyable. I happen to love this little program, and I've obviously done a lot to it, just adding my own little couple of pieces, and I assume you'll enjoy it as well. The one thing that this is not group therapy. For those of you who are not sure what I mean when I say that, this is not the place where, as we discussed, you'll see there'll be plenty of times for you guys for it to be interactive, for you to add your two cents and all of your pieces, and that's great. You'll have a great time, and hopefully it should be a lot of fun, and you'll learn a lot about yourselves and about your spouses. But this is not a forum, and I repeat this, just and we'll stop anyone who gets too involved, where if something comes up and you have a personal issue or problem, this is not where we share that. This is where we learn about certain concepts and we talk about them. We do certain activities amongst yourselves with your respective spouse. But it should not become where someone begins sharing their stuff. I'll give you all my cards. You know how to reach me. I will be happy to speak with anyone if you'd like. But that's not this in this particular form. So you should all feel safe and you'll not be asked, nor will I request to share any of that. Okay, just what this program is, and then we'll get into the actual program. There's a fellow by the name of Dr. John Gottman, wrote this book, which I brought in, so you should see it. I highly recommend it. I have a couple of books that I'll be recommending. It's called Seven Principles of Making Marriage Work. John Gottman, anyone heard of him? So he's actually a firm Jew, lives out in Seattle. He is a researcher. Yeah. So he's on a lot of clips. He's on CNN. Like the package they sent me, they forgot to send me the discs that I had ordered, where you could actually show clips of he and his wife running a program. And it's valuable at certain points to actually have them, and you see them as they produce it. He's wearing his yarmulke in all of the clips when he's on CNN, when he's on television, during these videos which they show throughout the country. He's got his little beard and his yarmulke in all of them. But it's totally irrelevant to the program that he put together. It's not a religious-based thing. It's a research-based program that he put together. In research, what he did is he created what he calls the Love Lab. He made a lab in Seattle, a one-bedroom apartment, and couples, he's been doing marriage research for 30 years, couples who would be part of his study would come to this lab for a weekend, voluntarily, and they would be recorded, every single thing that they did. They would be hooked up to monitors which would measure their heart rate and their blood pressure and their sweat glands, and they'd be videoed. Videos were not allowed in the bedroom nor in the bathroom. From 9 a.m. to 9 p.m., every single thing that was said between the couple was recorded. They'd be asked, you know, bring your books, bring your magazines, bring your pets, and just hang out for a weekend, talk about whatever you want. And then he and his colleagues would study the results, and they would codify all the different types of reactions, the way that people interacted. And they created a whole study in which they would measure how couples relate, and then they would use that. They'd follow the couples over years and years and years, and they've learned. He now claims that he can produce whether or not a couple will be divorced within listening to them for 7 minutes, 15 minutes. He's got a very short period where he could just listen to them, and based on all the studies that he's done on what makes for productive or successful interactions, he predicts with 94% accuracy whether or not the couple will still be together 5 years later. It's a frightening time. Can you imagine, you know, like sitting in a lab and like knowing that you're being watched and recorded? It's an unbelievable thing, but that's what this book is about. It's a book on marriage and the principles that he develops and he holds. These are the key things to work. And then he and his wife, Julie Schwartz Gottman, another Jewish lady, they developed a program taking those principles of this book and developing it into And Baby Makes Three, bringing it into how that affects once you have children. That obviously affects a marriage. And then they created a program which is called Bringing Baby Home, which is this basic program. I went out to San Francisco and went through a whole training seminar on this. So the books that you have, each one of the couples should have your own, and then one set of cards, which we'll get to, is their book on this workshop. As you go through, we'll go through a little bits and pieces of it during the session. You're welcome to take it home, read through it as much as you like. A lot of it has to do with the research that he did, if that interests you, and if it doesn't, you could skip right over that. What you will notice is a heavy chunk of it is based on first-time parents during that first year. There's a lot of information in here about that. So for those of you that's relevant to, that's great. If not, it's like they have it set up as like a six-part workshop, you know, an hour or two each. So I've shortened that because I'm not going to address that kind of stuff. I'm going to focus on the marriage aspect as it relates to culling from the two books and from the workshop into what we'll have. All right, enough about that. I hope that was clear. You're welcome to read in the books as much as you like, and I highly recommend Baby Makes Three, Seven Principles for Making Marriage Work. You can Google Gottman, you'll have all the books right there. Good stuff. Okay, let's start with a question. What would you say is the greatest gift we can give our children? That's an important question to think about because marriage is hard, raising children is hard, and there are only so many things that we can invest our time and our energy into. So if you had to choose something, the greatest gift that we can give our children, that our children at the end of 120 years, when they are thinking back to what us as parents gave them, what do we want them to say that we provided for our children? It's a very powerful question, but you could think about it for a minute. I'm just curious, as you think about that, throwing out some things, what you would say. Thoughts? Excellent. A good example to what you want as a person.
A good marriage.
Good marriage.
A loving relationship. A loving model.
Excellent. Other thoughts?
Nurturing environment.
Stability.
Positive attention.
Safe environment. Safe, nurturing, positive, warm environment.
Food.
Shelter.
Clothing.
Were you starved as a child?
Very fond of his memories.
So John Gottman, after all of his research, has come to the conclusion, as what some of you said explicitly and what others have touched on, a warm, positive relationship between the couple, between parents, is actually the greatest gift you can give your child. That will produce the warmth, that will produce safety, it will produce a model. When that's there, when a couple has a strong, developing, loving relationship between them, everything else for the child fits into place. And when you think about it, as we've all struggled through having children, dealing with those first couple months, which are really hard, and it doesn't really get all that much easier after that, the relationship we all know suffers. You don't need a study for that. You just know that it's difficult. It's a tough time. Everyone's struggling. And you see that in the children. The children pick up on that so fast when there's that lack of harmony amongst the parents. So Gottman holds, I haven't found the source of this yet. I've been looking where in Chazal, Mishnah, something in Pirkei Avos, where I could find that stated explicitly. But when I intuit it to be true, that relationship between a couple is the greatest thing that you can give to your children. Which means that we need to invest in that. That relationship, even though we spend so much time focused on the children, focusing on each other and creating that environment is actually the greatest gift that we can give. Did anyone here ever read the book Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus? People read it? Okay, I never read it, but I have a major problem with the book. Anyone remember what the tagline on the cover of the book says? The tagline on the book says, how to develop good communication and get what you want out of your relationship. So I've always had a major problem with that. Because the premise of the book, now I'm sure that there are great things in there and I probably would agree with it. I don't know if I haven't personally read it. Is that the premise is how to get what you want out of your relationship. And what's the problem with that? It is to take attitude. Now, maybe in the book he doesn't really deal with that, but that, when I saw that line on the cover, it was such an insight into where, what the tafkid, what the purpose, where it's going is, which is, how do I get what I want? You know, relationships, don't worry, men are different, we know that. Women think differently, men think differently. You all know that, you're all married, so you experience that daily. And so here's a book that tells you, how do you get that which you, what you want? And it's really not a Jewish perspective. The Jewish perspective is, it's all about giving. It's about giving.
It could be you as in plural.
Could be. I, the truth, I'm not into, you know, maybe yes, maybe no.
You would have said y'all.
No.
You got
it is about giving. And I remember hearing a shmooze when I was in Eretz Yisrael. One of the rabbis there had given a marriage shmooze, and the way that he put it, which has always stuck with me, is that your marriage is the context of your life. Everything that will take place in your life from here on out takes place in the context of your marriage. How you'll deal with your extended family, how you deal with the children, your job, your profession, your personal growth. It all takes place in the context when you walk into your home. That becomes, that's your life now. That's just what it is. And so developing that context is really primary and principal in creating that. Okay, let's start with that's all by way of an introduction. Question: is anything that is on or out of place so far? Makes sense. Okay, throw out a question. The most critical element in our marriage. I'm sure all of you have read books or been to other shmuzen or workshops, seminars, something on marriage. What? And you've heard lots of other ideas. If I had to throw out one idea that you would say, this is the element, this is the critical element in a successful marriage that you need to work on, what would that element be? And I'll throw out some choices for those that I'm sure you already have in your mind. Choices would be open and clear communication, or anything within the communication spectrum. Communication, a deep and developing friendship, strong commitment, or avoiding / resolving conflict. Either avoiding conflict, or if there is conflict, to resolve conflict. That are those four choices. Communication, friendship, commitment, or avoiding resolving conflict. What would you say is the critical element towards a successful marriage? Dan, what would you say?
Commitment.
Commitment.
Communication.
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 So, I think all of them. They're all important. I mean, these are easy for me to come up with as choices because I'm sure you've all heard somebody say along the line, this is the most important thing in your marriage. And I've heard all of those. So I'm just, as our personal, individually, it's interesting, I'm sure it's probably true. It could be that each one of us have particular weaknesses and we would say these things as far as what needs to be worked on. But I'm just curious, going around, what people think as far as these big issues, because these are the issues that we need to be working on. As if these are what we think is the main thing, if somebody thinks, you know, conflict and someone thinks commitment, so they both should be working 100%. But if you have to choose, communication. You're a lawyer by training.
This is what I would say, is resolve conflict through respectful communication.
You guys are disqualified. The last we're at a retreat where I did an introduction to this, so they're disqualified from answering that question.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Saying a good heart. Commitment, I think, consumes
them all. Communication.
Okay, that's what I would have expected. Communication trumps almost always. We have some other things, but communication, as we just go around, clearly seems to be the primary issue that people talk. Now, when people talk about communication, it's very often in the context of listening to what the other person is saying, being able to empathize. I'm sure you've all heard this, right? Be able to say, aha, so what you're saying is, and being able to then repeat and understand what it is that the other person is really feeling, and then being able to accept that and deal with it without responding. And this is all familiar. People have heard things along those lines as far as communication. Actively, right, those are the terms. So, Gottman holds strong, and I am very much a believer in this. When I read it and went through his stuff, I'm totally in agreement. And he actually disagrees with almost all of you. He was the only one who came onto what he holds, and that is friendship. That friendship and developing a deep and lasting friendship is actually at the core of a successful, passionate, intimate, developing marriage. And he writes that when you think about communication, you could be horrible communicators, you can make mistakes, you could be a terrible active listener, you can get past that if at the core you continuously develop a friendship. Now, I want to go through this because it's a very important thing.
You can only do that if you're committed to.
Correct. Now, that's why it's a little bit tricky. You do have to be committed to that. And there's no way you're going to be wrong. I knew that I was going to come around to explain that it was tied into commitment, that's for sure. But as far as which aspect of commitment, he writes friendship. Now, it's a funny thing when I first came across that, because obviously couples are friends, and you wouldn't get married to somebody who you weren't friendly with. But developing a relationship with a couple actually is constantly in touch, and developing an aspect of friendship often gets lost. Because especially with children, what happens is what had once been best friends often becomes a business relationship. There's a lot of things that need to be done around the house once there are children around. A lot of times it's before children. Certainly once there are children, it's a lot of stuff. And as the kids get older, it's more and more as far as the routines, as far as making a living, packing the lunches, bedtime, bath time, dinner time, reading books. And it very often transfers from what had been friends hanging out on the couch, doing whatever they just want to do, for taking long walks in the park. And there's a major, major focus of their energy and attention. And that mutual respect and commitment, enjoying each other's company, there are actually skills which go into that, which we did naturally when we were dating. You naturally are friends. You naturally develop that friendship. But there are actually skills and things which need to go in and be learned and worked on and practiced, which allow for that to be developed when the time crunch is such where it didn't necessarily happen in the same way that it did when we were dating. That means becoming very intimately familiar with each other, knowing each other's hopes and dreams as those things change, the struggles, the fears, all of those things, being in constant touch, develop that friendship. A friend once, I remember hearing one tape, said, if you want to share your life, you really need to share your days. Sharing days allows you to share lives. You can't share your life, in whatever that term you think that means, if you're not really in touch, in contact, developing a friendship on a daily level. Now, it's really very unromantic being involved in developing a friendship. But as all of you know, having been married, it's from the core of a friendship that real intimate, passionate relationship develops. It's only with some. Have you ever thought about going away for a romantic weekend after you're like angry and in a fight? It's a ridiculous concept. Like Wednesday night and Thursday night are like rough. And like Thursday night, someone goes, let's go away for the weekend. No. It's not exciting. You're not into that. If there's conflict there, those things don't work. And the key is developing and creating that. Now, one of the concepts that he used to develop this is a concept which he calls positive sentiment override. Which is a fancy term, just means that you really like each other, and because of the fact that you really like each other, you override all the other stuff that's going on around. So, for example, just taking an example, I like pulling things out of my own life, which happened just this week. Sent out to the store on a Thursday night, late, trying to get Shabbos ready, and it gives me a whole list, and one of the things are three bags of salad or something. Come back with the bag, it's already late, and she pulls them out and she says, "Where's the third bag?" What did it say? Two? Look at the list. It said three. Now, it's already late, and she's already stressed because the thing, and this is actually wasn't a Thursday night Shabbos, it was a function which was happening the next morning of brunch, and this was the night before. Where's the third bag? I don't have it. Now, what kind of reaction as husbands are we hoping that our wife is going to give us at that time?
Don't worry.
Exactly. Now, what reaction, women, do we actually get as husbands when that happens?
Grief. That's
right. Not getting it. It's already there. I put it, like, you see, it says three, it's clear. Now, that's like this happens. I'm not, like, I could have made this up, and you could have made up a thousand examples like that. So what happens is, that sin that's going to happen, that's going to be there. The question is, when everything is good in a relationship, and in Gottman's terms, you have what he calls a positive sentiment override, when I get the grief back, and I get something along the lines of, or the likes, or it's whatever it is, I'm able to say, if things are good, oh, she's stressed out because she's got to make lunch, or provide for the brunch, and I messed up. And that's sort of the end of it. If when things are not really well between the couple, when I get that grief, it becomes something personal. Something attacked. I feel attacked. And we all know when we feel attacked, we then respond. And it funnels out of control, or spirals out of control, once it's already there. Because we're not able to move past that. When we have a very good friend, a childhood friend who does something that upsets us, we're able to move past it because we know at the core we're really good friends. And we move past that a lot easier. And in marriage, we run into conflict all the time and we mess up all the time. And when there's that underlying issue there that says things aren't as good as they are, those things then explode because we take them in a much more personal, in a much more personal sense. You know, our Shabbos comes by, and it turns out an anniversary is going to be on a Shabbos. Works out great. Everyone makes plans. It's going to be exciting. Please, husband says, no company to Shabbos. It's just going to be so nice. Anniversary will just be the two of us. Great. Comes home Thursday night, and his wife has a little sheepish grin on her. What happened? So, well, Rabbi, final call, and there's this couple coming to town. He didn't have anywhere to put her. And I said, yes. Right, is it the exact same thing? Like, what's the reaction that wives are hoping their husbands will give them in that circumstance? No problem. It's fine. It's great. So we'll have company over Shabbat. What do they usually get? Like, sulking in a corner somewhere. Usually, like, we're very good at men at not actually responding in any words. Just very internally upset. Now, that's normal. Right? We had plans. This is supposed to be our big anniversary. We were going to have a quiet Shabbos together, and you ruined it. Right? That's a fact. There's no disputing that. It's just because Rabbi Feinbach calls to you. You can say no, and you did it. And now it didn't work out. This stuff is standard. I'm not making it right. That's what happens. How we handle that will really in primarily be dealt with based on what is the status, how the relationship is as that happens. Because the conflict will be there, how we're going to respond, relate, and deal with it when that happens is going to really, is going to be there. I had a guy call me. I had an incident two, three weeks ago where I was dealing with, so I was calling person A, because he's not really involved in the story, about a certain program he wanted to run in the shul. And he wanted to run it, and I told him that we weren't going to be able to do it for whatever reason. I had a phone call, a message on my voicemail from, let's call the guy Chaim. Chaim calls me and blasts me, leaves this just vicious voicemail on my cell phone. I can't tolerate the shul, you never run this kind of thing, it's disgusting, like, just vicious. Yeah, I'm horrible, shul's horrible. Like, who are you? I never spoke with this guy. I'm communicating with person X about it. Somehow person X must have told this guy, Chaim calls me up and he's just irate. So totally inappropriate. I sort of wait for him to call and apologize, which he never...
Chaim called me too.
Which he never does. Eventually, I see him face to face, still waiting for something. He doesn't give me nothing. So I call him up and I say, I want you to know that I think that that was totally out of line. Totally inappropriate to speak to anybody that way. Certainly not to call up your rabbi and speak that way. And besides, like, who are you? Like, I never spoke with you about this. You came in from left field. I don't even know what you heard about the conversation. I had a conversation with somebody else. His response to me was, how come you didn't call me to say, clearly, Chaim, he says to me, I'm normally a nice guy. And I clearly had some massive reaction. You should have called me to find out what was wrong. Like, what caused you to blow your top? So he's angry at me, waiting for me to call to apologize to him, or to make nice. Like, what happened that clearly he exploded, something was wrong. Why didn't I call to apologize, or to find out what was wrong? Because I know Chaim. And this, to me, wasn't out of the ordinary. I have had previous run-ins where I have gotten similar type of reactions. So when I got this particular phone call, my first thought was not, whoa, what happened to Chaim? That's so odd that he would do this. What must be wrong? And calling it was, there goes Chaim again, blowing his top over these small things. I don't know what to do with this guy. When's he going to call and apologize? In his mind, he's the nicest guy, totally calm, always under control, and he can't imagine that someone with a counseling background like me wouldn't have picked up on how odd it was for him to have called me and responded in such a way. Why wasn't I calling him to find out? I love, when he told me that, it was like such an insight in that's how we work. He was thinking he's always like this, and this is out of his norm. Now in our marriages, we do this all the time. We sort of create a standard as to the way that we expect people to, our spouses, to react or relate in certain circumstances. And then when certain things happen, is it out of the ordinary? Or is it something that we expect? The problem that we have where the tensions build are where we in our minds have these conversations with ourselves in which we say, oh, there she goes again. It's always. This is what I have to deal with. Maybe we've accepted it. This is my life. Nope. But that's the way that it is. Or she's always saying, he's always impossible. It's always the same thing over and over and over again. That's the conversation that we very often have in our mind. What Gottman is trying to present, what we'll go through, is if you can create a deep, developing, true friendship, you can always raise that bar as to what's your norm, what's your standard, so that when those things happen, and they will happen, we're able to honestly, naturally react by saying, whoa, that's odd. There must be something else going on. She must be under a lot of pressure that would happen. And we remove it from the personal attack because we're able to say, it's so clear to me that our baseline is here. This kind of response is different than the baseline, where we so often get into the habit and the pattern of saying, what really should be the abnormal, the negative response that we get, where we should be able to say, that's not the way that it's supposed to be. We get into the habit of saying, yeah, this is just how it is. It's always like this. And what he holds really creates that is that deep, lasting friendship. Okay. So far, so good? If you look at page 16... Let's open up your book for a second. I just want to show you the way that he maps this out in this program. They like to, what they call the sound relationship house. And it starts on the bottom and it works its way up into, what is that, 7 different parts of the program. And we'll work through as many as we can. I think about 3 probably tonight in developing. And the bottom 3 are all towards this concept of friendship. And I want to discuss and develop these ideas as we go through them. Love maps is the bottom. Now, love maps is the term which he quotes. This is a favorite concept of mine, and we'll bring up the cards in a moment. A love map is a term that this Gottman Institute has coined for this idea of really getting to know your spouse, developing a map of the ins and outs of who they are, the things they like, the things that they don't like, that what you want to do, and being able to, when you know that, you're able to relate to a spouse in a totally different way because you have that picture. When you know somebody, that's really love. You know, the word the Torah uses for love, for an intimate relationship, is vayeda, is to know, because within knowledge, that's really how we know people. Let's start with an example. I'm sure, Evelyn, you've heard of the concepts of introverts and extroverts. So this is just an example, but it's a personal favorite of mine. I'll go the other way around. Introverts are generally, people like to define them as people who are to themselves, are more quiet, enjoy quiet time, and extroverts are more socially active. A lot of psychologists today add an aspect of that, which, as a definition, I personally enjoy, and that is you could be equally adept socially, whether or not you're an extrovert or an introvert. The question is whether or not you draw your energy from being around people, or whether or not being around people zaps you of your strength. So, for example, I am an introvert. I don't find myself in, maybe you might, but socially awkward. Well, I'm not uncomfortable in social situations, but I find it exhausting. When I come home at the end of a Shabbos, in which I was in shul, and I was on, and we did the hosted company, and then it's back to shul for Shal Shudis. By the time Shabbos is over, I am just thoroughly smashed. I don't have any strength, energy, I'm entirely zapped. And what I would yearn to revive myself is just a quiet night, sitting on the couch, reading, sleeping. Something quiet by myself is what I would rejuvenate my energy. My wife is the exact opposite. She thrives and draws her energy from being around people. It's just exciting. When you're around, we could both be exhausted on a Shabbos. If we have somewhere to go, mostly Shabbos, like to a bar mitzvah or to whatever. Being around people, an extrovert actually like draws energy from that. They become more awake, alive, inspired, excited by being around people. If you ask them at the end of a long Shabbos, what do you want to do now that Shabbos is over? It's always go out. The introvert is thinking, go out. Like, let me just stay for a few minutes by myself. The extrovert thinks, like, that's torture. Like, be by myself, that's draining. The way that I want to rejuvenate myself is by going out and being with people. That's exciting. That's how I gain my energy. The question you always would ask is, if you had a few minutes to yourself when you're exhausted, what would you rather do? Would you rather be by yourself or be with other people? Now, I will throw this question out just as a first of many questions. You can do it to yourself amongst your spouse, but think to yourself how you would qualify yourself and how you would qualify your spouse, whether or not they are an extrovert or an introvert. Using that definition, do they draw energy by being around people, or does that exhaust them so that when they're done with that, they are tired? Once they've been around people, they're more tired. Like, I find Shabbos lunch exhausting because there's so many people around. It's so much entertaining. I'm exhausting. That for my wife, that's actually exciting. She's bouncing off the wall when everybody leaves at 4 o'clock. Whereas for me, that 3:30 to that last half hour, I have nothing left. I'm spent. And she's drawing energy. She's like drawing energy out of me. And anyway, that's just how we are an opposite type of couple. Not everybody's like that. But there's a great first step as a love map. Do you know what your spouse is at the end of a Shabbos? It's been an exhausting Shabbos. You hosted company. What would your spouse rather do? What would you rather do? Take a minute just to confirm your assessment of your spouse.
Is this just a way to let us know
that
we should leave on Shabbos?
No, yeah. Because Ricky would say, stay.
I'm trying to. You can go and take a nap. You can go and take a nap.
Yes, yes, these things change, 100%.
Yeah.
Okay, for me it's relevant to know what you are. How did you guys, did you get it right about your spouse?
I have a question. Do you mean when an introvert wants to be by himself, or just a relaxing with family?
Even with the family, you know, just, but it's not going out in a social setting where they don't have to be on. They're not around other people outside their immediate family. How many intermarried couples do we have? The same or different? Same? Different? Different? You guys the same or different? Sometimes it goes both ways.
The definition is really different than I would have thought.
We're using that such a definition.
Using that definition.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Good enough. Wise marks?
I still don't know.
Okay, that's fair. So in other words, sometimes there's no set rule where it's always one way or the other. But you would say more often the opposite than the same.
More often opposite.
We say it depends on the people.
Opposite. Now, most of us were opposite. I think out of the 8, if you include me, 9, I think we had 7 were opposites and only 2 were the same. Now, this is a fascinating piece of information, which you may have, I'm sure you all were aware of this. But it's great when you put it out there because you probably run into the same situation that I had this past Motzei Shabbos, in which we had plans already made, which I did not make, obviously, to go out on Motzei Shabbos. At the end of this past Shabbos, I had spoken 3 times in shul. We hosted company. I took my son to Father Son Learning. By 8 o'clock at night, I am finished. But my wife had made plans for us to go out. Now, in my mind, I have an entire conversation in my mind that says, please, the only thing I want is to stay home tonight. That's it. Please, just let's just stay home. But no, that wasn't an option because we already were going out. Now, I know that my wife is going to enjoy this because she's just as exhausted as I am as Shabbos ends, but that this is going to be fun and exciting and full of energy for her. But I don't have any conversation with her. I don't tell her where I'm holding, except that in my mind I'm thinking, maybe let's just make it short. Let's just do an hour or two, we come back home, and you could be happy, I'll be happy, it'll be great. I never say that. So what happens instead, since I never have that conversation, so instead what happens is we're out for 4 hours, 3.5 of which I am a miserable human being. I am no fun to be around, because I'm empty. And I have no end point in which we discuss, please do me a favor, let's just call it at this time so that I can get into bed because I'm finished. So instead, so we suffer through 4 hours in which I'm really not a lot of fun to be around. And then we get in the car and she says, what's wrong with you? Like, you were a mess tonight. Like, that was totally inappropriate. And we're with other people and you're not present. Now, that's exactly what I could have predicted would have happened when there's not just being in touch with where we're at. I have a very different need on Motzei Shabbos than my wife does. But we didn't ever really communicate that. We didn't speak about it. And so we ended up in a situation which ended up bad for both of us. She's angry at me. I'm just miserable because we're doing everything that I don't want to be doing because we hadn't worked that out. Now, if 7 out of the 9 of us are opposites, a good chunk of the time at least, on this one issue, that means you regularly have an issue in which one of you would prefer to be in a social setting, and one of you would want nothing other than being by themselves. Now, marriages are often opposites in this because we like being around other, you know, it just works for us very well. We find, if someone were to do a study, I'm sure a significant majority would be intermarried couples as far as this one issue goes. But when you put in the context, as he's putting of a love map, know your spouse. Be aware of all the different aspects of who they are, what they're about, things they like, things they don't like, which we'll talk a lot more about. I love this one example as a starting point, as a clear example, because this comes up all the time. Oh, should we be social? Should we not be social? Well, one of the two of you is wanting it a lot more than the other. Being sensitive to the other's needs, the other's nature, and then balancing off of that as far as knowing what that is. Now, the word that he uses of a map, a love map, is I love that word because what do we use a map for? Right? When you don't have a map, you say, well, I'm going to go take this road. Where is it going to lead you? don't know. I think it'll get me to where I need to go, but if you don't have a map, so you usually don't end up exactly where you think you're going to go when you head down the road if you don't know exactly, if you don't see the big picture. So I love that term. He doesn't bring this as an example. I just love that term because we think we know our spouses very well. And so we head down a certain path, certain that this set of behavior is going to lead me to the promised land. And somewhere along the road, it hit a dead end. And we're not really sure why that is. And the answer is because you didn't really get, your spouse doesn't, that's not the map. That's just not what he or she is about. That's not how to get to where you want to get to. You have to actually map that out. Now, there. Before we, I'm going to do one more thing before we get to these cards. I want to interject a whole. Anyone need a break? And I'm sort of babbling. I'm doing all right. Anyone ever heard of the five love languages? Most yes. Almost everyone yes. Yes. No. No. Yes. Okay. So do it quickly. Annabelle, yes. No.
Yes.
Yes. What? So there are four?
One is a sign language.
Yeah. So this is worth interjecting at this point. Now, Gottman doesn't talk about this concept, but this is Dr. Gary Chapman, not a Jewish guy. He's a preacher of something or another, I don't know. But he has these what he calls the five love languages, in terms of the way, the language of love that we speak and that we hear, that we receive, is different. And he quantifies five different, which I want to, as we go through them, this will be our next little exercise. You need to put down the top three of the five for yourself, and also guess what the top three of your spouse is, at least now during this stage of life. Five languages are as follows. If I had a little slideshow, I would put this up here. Number one language that people speak is the quality time. Quality time, brief description that when I want to be, if you want to show, if my wife wants to show me that she loves me, or the other way around, if I want to show her that I love her, the language that she speaks is quality time. She needs for me to spend quality time with her. And that's simply the language. She doesn't want to get gifts, she doesn't want to have other things, she just wants me to be with her. She wants to spend a half hour on the couch every night, just catching up on the day, and that is the language that she speaks. If you want to tell me that you love me, that's how you do it. It's through spending quality time together. Language number two is words of affirmation. Compliments, giving positive feedback, saying things about your spouse that you enjoy, that you are impressed with, complimenting. That's a language that people speak. The primary language that I need to hear from my spouse that she's proud of me. I need to hear from her that she's impressed with my job, with the way that I'm making a living, with the way that I'm parenting. But I need to hear that. It's important for me to actually hear the words from my spouse, you are doing a good job, and the compliments that I hear are the primary language that I speak. Language number three is gifts. Some people they need to receive gifts. Now those who speak that language, you know, birthdays, anniversaries, those kinds of, if you have a spouse who speaks the language of gifts, you better learn how to give gifts. And the biggest problem that a lot of couples have is when one spouse speaks the language of gifts and the other one doesn't, like, what's the big deal? It's just an anniversary. Like, who gives gifts? Well, if one of the spouses, a wife, for example, is expecting a gift, and not just expect it because that's what you're supposed to do. That tells me that you love me. The fact that you spent the time thinking about it, it's not a matter of money, but it's a matter of the effort and the time, that says you love me. You spent the time to give me a gift. And when you don't have a gift, when the anniversary rolls around, and you knew for months that the anniversary was rolling around, you're really saying that you don't really care about me, you don't value me, because the language that I speak is when you give me gifts. That's a language. Someone who doesn't speak the language, if a couple meets up and they neither of them speak that language, then it's great. You don't have to give a gift for every anniversary because no one's expecting it. No one speaks that language. But if you have a spouse who does, that's the primary language. Language number four is acts of service. Doing things. making sure that the house is neat, making sure that you run errands for me, that the husband does the shopping on Thursday night, that you set the table, that you clean the dishes, whatever you may come up with, being around, helping me make lunches at night for the kids for school, that is the greatest sign that you love me, is if you'll take care of this, doing something from it. This is hitting a chord, I imagine, somewhere. So we know what you're learning, right? Now, these things change, by the way, over time, and in different stages of life, they are different, right? When you got married, an act of service might have been irrelevant because there weren't kids around and they were fine. And as the family grows and develops, that kind of thing becomes much more important. But that idea, the way that you show me that you love me, or the language that I receive love, is in acts of service. When you do things for me, that is how you show me that you love me. Language number 5 is physical touch. A hug, a kiss, an embrace, walking through a park, intimacy, whatever, all of those things are included within physical touch, and it's through that you show, that you would walk out of the house without giving me a hug is like the biggest sign that we're in a fight. I can't even believe you would leave without giving me a kiss on the way out. Another couple, like, that's not the way that they communicate. Neither one of them communicates through that. And therefore, that was a big nothing. But if you speak a language where you're giving me physical contact, a hug, a kiss, all of those things is your primary language of love, then that's an important thing. Now, obviously, as religious Jews, someone who speaks the language of physical touch has a significant impediment 2 weeks a month in which you can't do that. And that's why when I saw him frame it in this manner, if that's the language you speak, you are then all the more so have to be aware and sensitive that your spouse's primary love language, you can't really do. You're on hold in a significant manner for one of the ways in which you convey your love, and therefore you need to be up to date on other methods and means of doing so. That is one of the... those are the 5. So it's worth it. So having those 5 down... Next little exercise is to list your top 3 that you speak, meaning the things that you want of your spouse. If you wanted your spouse to show you that she or he loves you, these are the 3 primary ways in which they would need to do so. And then you need to guess, hopefully it's more than a guess, what your spouse's top 3. Now these things change. There are more pens. Anyone else need a pen? They change over time, as I mentioned, of different stages of your life. But to be able to do so is key when you think about creating a love map of your spouse, of being familiar with what that is. Alright, after you put that down, take a few minutes and see how well you did with your spouse. Okay, I hope most of you did fairly well on that. Whether or not we actually act on those things and we're good in terms of actually communicating to our spouse in the way that they want to be communicated to, is a different story. But at least you need to know. You need to know whether or not, at this point in time, the greatest thing you can do for your spouse is make lunches for the kids, or clean up the house, and that's what they really want. And you come home with a gift. And, you know, gift isn't... it's actually much more frustrating when a husband comes home with a gift and all his wife wanted was you to do the dishes. And like, what are you doing? Not only did you spend money, you put all your energy and time into that. I'm not interested in that. I really want this. And that is, it's a great little exercise, and I hope that you will all make use of that. In your cards, you have little packets. You could open them up. What's that? Oh, it's going to get worse. Yes, I think so. What's that? Yeah, the love map card. Okay, these are great little tools, these cards. So take out the red ones, the deep red ones.
Blood red.
Blood red. Okay, there's one set of cards per couple. So these cards are great little cards. These are a great way that they developed for developing a love map, for being able to really get in touch with your spouse. I don't want to spend too much time tonight. It's already almost, it is 9 o'clock already. I want to do one more thing tonight, but I want to at least spend some time doing this. There are two sets of cards. You have the red cards and you have the orange cards. This will be a homework assignment. I don't know if I mentioned there's going to be homework assignments and everything.
Can you call this like little red, little orange?
Yeah, that works. Think. So the red ones are what they label love map cards. These cards are a great little tool for getting in touch, spending the time to get to know each other, even though you all do know each other without question. But these little cards develop that to another level. It takes it to an ability to really work things through. And the way that these cards work is that you take turns going through. If you were to go through all of them, I think I would just go through, take out.
The bear card.
Yeah. There's only one restaurant in town. You can know what your favorite restaurant is. Unless you have not been taking her out enough, and then she has no favorite restaurant. That's the only other possibility for that one. If you go through some of these cards, the way that this works is, in the red cards at least, each one of you have to answer on behalf of your spouse. So as you see the cards, say, what's my favorite activity to do, or what's my favorite vacation? So your spouse has to be able to answer that for you. Yes. Now, in the book, the way that they do, he has like 60 or so questions in this book, and he creates a whole little game. Like if you get it right, you get 4 points. If you get it partially right, you can get 1 point. You can make a whole little game out of it for those of you who are competitive. The questions are a lot of fun because they bring out all sorts of interesting stuff that sometimes you don't necessarily know about yourself, and certainly you didn't know about your spouse. And the questions are aimed at actually bringing that out. The orange cards are what they call open-ended questions. Now, open-ended questions, as you all are familiar with that term, everyone has heard the conversation, somebody being made fun of. Teenagers are the classic target for this. How was your day at school? Great. What did you do? Nothing. Fine. And conversation is over. Whose fault is that conversation? Right, it's the parent's fault. It's the one asking the question. For when you ask a question that allows for a one-word answer, you're usually going to get a one-word answer. So the trick is, and when you want to further and develop, is learning and getting used to asking open-ended questions. Now, it's worth mentioning here, for all of you with children who are a speaking age, which is everyone, but you guys will get there soon, Ms. Shem. You have to practice that with our kids also. Developing this concept of a love map is critical when it comes to our children also. How well do we know our children? Do we know their friends? Do we know what they make, like if the mother is the one making lunch for school every day and she goes out of town, are we helpless and clueless as to what our kids are eating for lunch? Are you involved? Like, I have no idea. That's a bad thing. Now, I'm also pretty clueless, and I try to get involved. I forget, and I can't remember who gets what. But there's a certain level of involvement in our child and children's lives that we should actually know what they like to eat for lunch. It's a helpful piece of information to be involved. My parents were in my house the Shabbos, and I overheard my mother saying to a brother-in-law of mine, "How did your big meeting go?" And I remember thinking, I didn't know anything about it. And it was so indicative to me that I really am not involved in his life at all, because he's clearly, it was like a huge meeting which was going to decide his whole future plans, and I had no idea about it. Those little things, I'm really not involved in his life. Well, when that happens with each other, we don't know about each other's what's going on at work, we don't know what's going on with our kids, you're out of touch. And the key thing is making sure that you stay in touch about those things. And these questions are great. The orange cards are the opposite of the red ones. The red ones, you have to be able to answer for your spouse. The orange cards are where you ask your spouse, and they actually just answer it. It's long-term questions. What are your plans 5 years from now? What are things that we could work on our marriage? What are ways that we could be having more fun than we're having now? And there are ways of bringing that out. So what I want to do, it's already 9, let's just do 10 minutes. You're welcome to make use of different areas of the house because it's worth it. The activity is worth it, and for homework you don't have to do the rest. But do like 3 red cards and 3 orange cards. It's worth moving around just so that you could actually be open as you answer, because if you're sitting right next to somebody else, sometimes it's a little bit more uncomfortable. You could stay if you'd like. But do for 10 minutes, do a couple of red ones and a couple of orange ones, and just take the opportunity to work them through. I hope you found that. I've thoroughly enjoyed this little activity when I've done it with Rifki. It's just a great little thing. You keep the cards in the car. It's a great little thing that you take trips, you pull them out, and you just sort of, like, what should we talk about? These cards are great. They give great stuff to talk about, especially the orange ones. The open-ended question, they allow for a lot of good stuff and good conversations, and I hope you found them, they accomplish what they need to accomplish. It allows for a conversation, and it really opens you up to where your spouse is, and these things change a lot of the questions. What's that?
The answers are not on track.
Yes. So the other thing to do, for those of you with older kids, are to create these cards for your kids at age-appropriate levels. And at the dinner table, it's a great activity. Once a child is already speaking, you could already do them at an age-appropriate level where you actually sort of go around. And I gave these cards out this weekend, so there was an adult who had all the children are. The youngest child in the family is, I think, in 8th grade. And they took some of the open-ended questions, some of the questions they were doing at the dinner table. They were having a blast guessing what, because each one of the children were old enough to really have developed personality already. And the whole family was sort of going around guessing and answering for each other. She said they had such a great couple of nights of dinner conversations through these things. So it's a great thing to do, create them for your family at an age-appropriate level, and you'll be surprised at what your children think they know about you. It's sometimes a little bit unnerving. But just like we have opinions about our parents, and we think we know what they're all about, and their idiosyncrasies, our children are doing the same things to us. But in any case, that's all the first level of this program that he holds of developing the sound relationship. This house in which you're building is a love map. Getting to know your spouse and continuously updating that map as things change, as life changes, as situations change, as children get older and different. The questions that you'll have and the answers to these questions change, and it constantly being in touch and spending the time to deal with them, being familiar with the different love languages as those change. That's level number one. I want to get through quickly level number two, and then we'll send you off with the homework assignment. Level number two is fondness and admiration. Communicating affection and respect, being able to actually communicate that. I shared a story in a drusha, in a sermon that I gave a couple of weeks ago, and some of you probably were there, most of you probably were not, and I want to repeat the story because after I said it, I have gotten so many comments about it, and I have just played it over my head so many times and been so blown away by it. A couple of weeks ago over Yontif, many, many days of Yontif that there were, I found myself walking from one place to another on Yontif afternoon by myself, and coming towards me was a certain individual who has remained nameless since I've told the story. And when I saw him coming towards me, I was very excited. Here it's Yontif afternoon, I'm by myself, he was by himself, we're going to have a chance to schmooze, it's going to be awesome. And as we got a little closer, I noticed that it wasn't actually the person who I thought it was somebody who just looked like him. A little bit disappointing, I said, Yontif, and we just walked on. And I was so amazed at how excited I had been, and at how disappointed I was that it wasn't. As I continued my walk, I said to myself, "What was it about this guy? What does he do that I was so excited to be with him, and so disappointed that it wasn't actually him, it was somebody else?" And it came to me immediately that this individual, every single time I'm with him, compliments me on the job that I'm doing at Shul. He says, "Hey, you're doing awesome, I love that you're doing X, Y, and Z, and you handled this perfectly, and that speech you gave was amazing, I loved it." Every single time I see him, he says something nice about what I'm doing. I love it. There is nothing like it. It is so much fun to be around him. I was visibly excited to run into him in the streets because, and I noted to myself, I had already been thinking, wonder what he's going to talk about this time. And then when it wasn't him, I was visibly, noticeably, within myself, disappointed because, it's so much fun to be around that person. And that was an amazing insight to me, that we, as human beings, I from all the feedback that I've gotten when I said to that, when I told over that story, most people seem to be exactly like me. We love compliments. Whether or not it's our primary love language or not, it is something that is just a great feeling. How awesome is it if our spouse fills that role? That they are so open with their compliments. So much do they actively, verbally comment on things that we do that we're excited to come home. We're excited to be around them because we are getting that constant feedback. That is an amazing... Now, what happens is, in a marriage, we probably were like that when we were dating, and certainly when we were engaged. And then we fit into our routines in which we just sort of expect certain things. It's going to be this way. You're always going to make Shabbos, and I'm always going to do whatever. So the fact that you still put together a magnificent Shabbos doesn't get the same response that it did during the first month that we were married, because you always do that. Even though it's still just as amazing, and it might be even more difficult for you now to put it together with all that's going on as life continues, but we don't verbalize it in a serious manner the way that we normally do. So you guys know. Anyone here enjoy writing mitzvah notes for your children? I used to hate it. I'm so happy that somebody wanted it. I used to despise mitzvah notes. It was the greatest source of stress in my home. On the way out to school, every morning, there were certain teachers who were like, we had to have it, and it was just, what? And we just rack our brain, we'll come up with something creative every morning. It was horrible. Rifki's good. It was horrible. And it occurred to me... Yeah, I know. There's a reason why I'm bringing this up. It occurred to me that mitzvah notes are actually a fantastic tool as a parent to have to open up your eyes and notice good things that your children are doing. And it occurred to me that it was a horrible indictment on me as a parent that I could not come up with something positive my child had done the previous day. That is absurd. That as a parent, I had not had my eyes opened to something. I mean, a mitzvah note does not need to be elaborate. They can be repeat performances. It was embarrassing when I realized you have nothing good to say about your child that he did yesterday. You noticed nothing. He said thank you. He threw away his dinner when he was done. He cooperated in getting out of the bed. Like, nothing? Horrible. So I've come to appreciate what it forces you to do. And when Rifki and I started paying attention, we started making a much bigger deal throughout the day because we would start noticing it. We would start looking for things that the children are doing because, not because we're going to have to write a mitzvah note, because you should, as a parent, be aware constantly of the things your children are doing and call them on it. Always. Point it out. And it changes the entire environment in the home in which you'll have, because we're really good at naturally calling out the mistakes they make. Like, we don't need any training. There's no workshop in the world that says, this is how you notice the things your children are doing wrong. We're naturals at that, because we notice it, we're good at it, it's just that. But to notice the good things, we let that slide by. So it slides by with our children, and worse, it slides with our spouses. They're doing so many wonderful things, each one of us, for each other, for the kids, for the community, and it doesn't get noticed because we don't actually have a mitzvah note system, even though it would be cute if we were to do such a thing, and to create a little, or those post-it notes kinds of things, like post-it notes for parents, in terms of, you put the kids to bed so well last night. I loved hearing you read that story to them. It was great seeing you snuggle in bed with them. Thank you for handling whatever it may be. is a wonderful thing. So the last little thing that I want to do before we are going to stop on time, there are two critical components. A, noticing and being able to compliment. There's another critical component which a lot of us are very, very poor at, and that is accepting compliments. A lot of us are not good at that. And what happens when we don't accept a compliment well, the person who has given us the compliments will very soon stop giving compliments because it didn't go over very well. I did it. Learn how to say, thank you, I'm so glad you noticed. Thank you, I did that for you. Thank you, it's because I love you. It's because I love the kids. Being able to accept a compliment is a part of the component of being able to do it. Take a look quickly at page 42. And we'll do this. I would have loved to spend more time on it, but we'll leave this sort of as a... We'll do it quickly now, just for 2 minutes. Put together a wonderful list. Lots of adjectives and definitions and skills. Go through the list. Pick out three that your spouse has that you admire. And come up with the actual story, incident, example in which they demonstrated that trait. So you need to find on this list three things that your spouse has done or a trait that they demonstrate that you are impressed, admire them for, and then be able to give as an example something that they did. You know, just taking number one, right on the list is loving, being able to show an example where they demonstrated that trait. And then come up with two things that could be the same as some of the other three. Two things that you, a trait that your spouse has that you want to see in your children. It might not be the same. In other words, it could be certain things on this, you know, your spouse is particularly artistic. And you're very impressed and admire that and you want to compliment them for making up signs for the kids or whatever. But you don't necessarily want to see that in your kids. You know, if they have it, great. If they don't, they don't. But three things that you admire about your spouse that you're able to say to them with an example of something that they've done to demonstrate that, and two traits that you want to see that your spouse has in your children. It's a great task, and it's to be able to, as the listener, it's going to be homework because we're running out of time. So you can, I guess you can do it from home. So three things, and then to be able to say it, to verbalize it to your spouse, and to be able to accept it, to hear it, and to learn how to say and to accept a thank you on a compliment that you receive. An example. You have to give an example where you have seen something in which your spouse has demonstrated the trait that you admire and that you want to compliment them on.
And regarding the kids, would you say one that our spouse has that we want?
Two that you want to see in your... Two of the... No, they could be separate ones. They could be separate ones. Yeah. None of us, you're right. They don't have to be the same. Okay, so the homework for this week is A, to make sure you get this done. And I would, after doing the main thing, the three and the two, I would, the homework would be every day that each one of you gives a compliment. It doesn't have to be from this list where you find the same kind of task, but that once a day, one compliment where you pay attention to actually say something to your spouse about something that they've done. Just to note and to compliment. It's sort of like the mitzvah notes for parents. I would actually recommend writing it out. I think it's great to have. At the end of the week, you actually have like 7 compliments from your spouse on things that you've done. It's a wonderful thing. There's nothing great, a little post-it notes. You can collect them. That's homework number one. Homework number two is from the love maps, is to spend at least, I don't know what you want to call it, 20 minutes on the cards, whether or not you want to just designate a 120-minute period or do a couple minutes a night, but to be able to get back next week, having actually spent some time on the cards, it's a great activity. Designate the time. Force yourselves to find 20 to 30 minutes on the cards and one compliment a day as far as that goes. All right, that's number one. You are my guinea pigs. This is the first thing. I'm open to comments, suggestions, anything to make it better is fine. I have not done this before, so whatever we can do to make it better is all good for me. Thank you all for coming.
Thank you.
next week.
Next week.